I love the beginning moments because it's always like, hey, do we go in with a, we know each other so well, this is amazing, or it's like, oh, welcome, let's introduce the listener to who you are. Hello and welcome to your weekly dose of Third Culture Conversation. Each week I have a great guest that I've had the chance to personally connect with, and we explore the history of their family and culture and what role that it has played in the way that they think and what they are doing today. See, I really believe that like-mindedness attracts, and that's why I feel that me and my guest today connected from the instant that we met. We studied in the same university and had some mutual friends, but we didn't get to know each other until the end of year one. And in today's conversation, we recall that first time we met. But I'm really excited for you today because whether you're a regular to the show or a connection of the guest or the appeal of the topic is what's led you here, I have no doubt that you are going to take a lot from this conversation. In part one, we cover the early part of Saba's life and dive into the fascinating history of Iran. And I'll give a bit more on what to expect in part two at the end of this episode. So wherever you are and whatever you may be doing, it is a pleasure to have you join me for this Third Culture Conversation with Saba. But this is really exciting for me because obviously we know each other from university, and I would say in terms of time spent, we didn't spend that much time together, but the quality of the time that we did spend together, even though it was, you know, in the library revising, even back then, like the conversations we had weren't just your standard, like, oh yeah, can't wait for exams to be over. Like, what's your favorite topping on pizza? Like, we had some pretty insightful life-based conversations, right?
Yeah, we did. I remember actually, like, I think it was almost sunrise. We were walking back from the library and we were having some deep conversations. And I was like, oh my God, how is our minds even working? They're like,
I know, right? Exactly. If I remember right, did we go to like the newsagent and then...
get food, I think.
Yeah. But I can't remember what it was. I just felt like we should be sleeping, but nah, you know, before we go to sleep, let's just eat some junk and then go to sleep because back then our bodies were able to deal with that. I couldn't even imagine trying to like firstly stay up that late now and then also like wharf down a bunch of junk.
Same. Literally, I'm like asleep at like 11 o'clock every night. I don't know how I used to call them all-nighters, but yeah.
Sign of age.
I know. No, don't say that. Age is just a number.
That is true. Yeah, so we had those moments and then we lost touch, but we always had each other on social media, right?
Yeah.
And I know that you moved out, but I don't really know anything else about like how, why, what exactly happened, when. So it's really interesting because for me, this is just as much of a personal conversation to be like, hey Saba, let's catch up and see what we've been up to. But I just know it will make an interesting discussion anyway, so it just fits in really well with this. So firstly, welcome to the Journey Onwards podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
No, don't be silly. I keep quite free reins in the beginning, and what I like to do, it's kind of the premise of the whole thing, is find out why you are the way you are and why you do the things you do or the ambitions that you have. But also, that's quite common that other podcasts do it and conversations touch on this. But I kind of like to know the how behind the why. And by the how, I mean going back beyond. So your upbringing, your parents, the way they were, where they came from, how that has impacted all the whys that we will get into. That's really what I try and get out of these conversations. So I hope you're ready.
Go for it.
So on that, it's over to you to kind of kick off. I'd love to know whichever angle you want to start with, but going back to probably your backstory. So involving your grandparents or your parents, whichever point you want to start at. What was their story?
Okay, so maybe it's a good place to start with my parents. My dad moved to the UK when he was 15. So he moved from Iran. And it was before the revolution, so it was early 70s.
Okay.
And my mom, also Iranian, moved when she was 21, so she moved in the like mid-80s. My mom moved after the revolution, so after the war with Iran and Iraq, and after the revolution, and a few years later I was born. So I was brought up in Essex, so I was born and raised in the UK. And as far as my childhood goes, like, I was very, very privileged. Like, looking back, my parents were absolutely amazing. But growing up as a third culture kid was extremely tough.
Yeah.
Literally, when I heard you were doing this, I was so happy because I thought, like, and honestly, thank you for even starting this, because I thought, if I was a kid and I was growing up and I had access to such a podcast, man, my childhood would have been so much more easier.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to know. And it's funny because I was brought up in a big family. Like, my mum was one of six. And when she moved to Iran, she wasn't alone. So they kind of all moved together apart from one of my aunties. So I was brought up with loads of cousins. So we were all kind of in the same situation in terms of, I don't know if you want to call it an identity crisis, but we never spoke about it. And it's so weird. Like, there were so many of us, like, older than me, younger than me, and we kind of silently struggled. And I mean, it is kind of difficult to admit, but it was a struggle, especially in our area, because our area, it wasn't multicultural, or it wasn't like people hadn't, they didn't even, I remember like saying, oh, where are you from? Iran. Like, your parents are like, Iranian, you're Iranian. Oh, does that mean you're from Iraq? And I was like, no, Iran is a different country to Iraq. And it was like having to educate people. And no, it was a struggle, because we definitely didn't fit in. I mean, we looked different. So to all the other, everybody was like blonde, and we really stood out. But it was nice to have each other. But like I said, it was a silent struggle. And
I love the way you phrased that, actually.
To see you now have a podcast is fantastic, because I feel like if I could have Googled something, I mean, at the time, Google wasn't like a thing, like when we were a kid. If I could, like, Google, and if I had access to such a podcast and I could hear people who had, like, a similar struggle, it would have really helped me. Because I think up until 18, I was struggling. And I can say probably all my cousins were as well.
No, it's really nice that you've said that and you get it. And even this term, third culture kid,
I didn't even
understand it really until really recently. And a lot of people that I've told that, you know, my focus of the podcast is now on that, they're like, oh, you know, what does that mean? What is the third culture? Because obviously we would be able to identify as the children of immigrants. And it's quite often it's the same thing, a child of immigrants being a third culture kid, but the focus of what it's about, right? So being a third culture kid means you have your home environment where you have the influence of your parents and your family culture. But then, you know, when you go out into the playground or into the school environment and you hang around with other local kids, you probably behave differently. You act differently. You, not necessarily in a bad way, but you might put on a different front. You speak differently, all of that. And it's cool to be able to know and navigate both. But like you say, you mentioned like the crisis and the struggle side of it. You don't really talk about it because you're like, oh, I lead these two different identities. Where do I really fit in? Do I fit in fully with either? And a lot of the time, what I've got out of this conversation I've had is people never feel like they really fit in on either end.
No, exactly. Exactly.
To your point, there's others just like us out there who have that same thought, and it is more just about knowing that there's other people, right? They don't even need to directly be able to help you.
Yeah. And it's knowing that it's actually okay to be different, and kind of embracing not being, like, for me, fully Iranian and not being fully British. Like, I am my own kind of person. And you know what? Now moving to Iran, if I didn't go through all of, like, the challenges that I did as a child, it would have been so much more difficult for me moving out here. Like, I feel like all the skills that I learned growing up, trying to fit in and just kind of trying to embrace and be content with who I am, which is kind of not fully Iranian, not fully British, but my own kind of person. Yeah. And being content with that, that has really helped me fit in today. And I'm so proud of being a third culture kid. But I think if you probably asked me at like 14, like, who are you? I would have been like, British.
Yeah.
Like, and I mean, Iran always kind of had, as I was growing up, not a very good reputation. I mean, we didn't really learn a lot about it in school. I don't know about your school, but we didn't learn a lot about it in school. And in the news, it was always, like, I remember like 9/11 happening. The first thing they said was, it's the Iranians.
Yeah.
And all the kids at school were like, oh my God, it's your family. I'm like, no, my family have been like living in the UK for like years. It's got nothing to do with my family. And it wasn't even the Iranians. It was like from like Saudi Arabia or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And but it was like, oh my God, like it's that Iranian side of me. And then it was like Muslims and terrorism. And it was like, oh, I just want to be away from it all.
Yeah.
And then I moved to London at 18. And I remember, I don't know if you remember Susie.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember like meeting her and she was like, where are you from? And I was like, I'm British. She was like, no, you're not. You don't look like you're English. And I'm like, well, no, like my parents are Iranian, but I was born and raised here. She was like, never, ever say that.
Yeah, and she's really strong-willed as well. Yeah.
I was like, what do you mean? She was like, why are you saying that to people? Like, you're Iranian. Your mum and dad are Iranian. Even though you were born and raised here, you're still Iranian. And I was like, and she kind of really helped me embrace that Iranian side and moving to London and seeing all these kind of different cultures. Made me like so much more happier and get more content with my identity.
That's amazing. I love that. Because I always like finding out what people's, doesn't necessarily have to be pivotal moments, but like key moments in their life where they're really able to identify better or break out of that feeling like you're struggling or confused. Yeah. So it's nice that it was Susie, and I went skiing with her as well. She's a lot of fun.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
she is a lot of fun. I'm still in touch with her, so
that's awesome. Yeah, send my regards.
She's going to be so happy that I brought her up in the podcast, I think.
Susie, take a listen.
Yeah.
Before we get, I actually want to touch on some of what those struggles may have been. But one thing I wanted to ask, so the time at which your parents moved, so they went before the revolution.
Yeah.
Firstly, was that fairly common, or was it quite, they stepped out of the norm when they did that? And also why?
Yeah.
Why did they decide to come to the UK?
So my dad went to boarding school in the UK.
Okay.
And he went before the revolution, and it probably wasn't common at the time. I mean, education wasn't really available for a lot of families because of the class differences.
Yeah.
And my granddad was working in the National Oil Company, which later then became BP, and he had quite a high position. And he would travel to London a lot. And he always wanted my dad to, like, my dad was quite smart. So out of the kids, he chose my dad to, like, take him to the UK. And then my dad boarded. So my dad has a strong, like, British side to him as well. Like, speaks English, like, not with an accent, but with a British accent.
Awesome, yeah.
My mum, however, my mum has a slight, a story. Like, my mum, so she moved after the war.
Yeah.
My granddad used to work with the American embassy. So he had a printing company, a printing factory, and he used to print loads and loads of calendars for America. And in their calendars for the embassy, they actually had the Shah's birthday as a national holiday.
Oh,
and
wow.
Before the revolution happened, the embassy told my granddad to take the Shah's birthday out of the calendar. And my mom actually told me the story of when he came home and like everything was amazing in Iran and life was very luxurious.
Yeah.
And like basically it wasn't how it is now. Very different. And my granddad said, oh my God, the weirdest thing has happened today. And then he said, the American embassy is to have told me to take the Shah's blood. I think something's happening. Like something must be happening.
Yeah.
Let's like take some of our money abroad. Because, like, this is really worrying. And my mom said the whole family laughed. They were like, oh, like, nothing's going to happen. We've got the best relationship
paranoid.
With the West. You're just paranoid. And then, like, literally, I think less than a year, the revolution happened. And the Shah was overthrown. And my granddad was like, if only we moved then, we would have been so much richer. So they had money, so they were able to move. Not a lot of families did. But when the revolution happened, obviously the currency like went crazy, as you can imagine. Mm. So like they lost so much money. So the life that they had here, from like a driver and a chef and like a huge house, like all of a sudden went to a smaller house, like couldn't like afford all the things, luxuries that they had in Iran. And it was a struggle because my mum actually didn't want to move. She really wanted to stay in Iran. She found it really hard and she decided to stay. And it's a really long story. I'm not going to like say in the podcast, we'll be here till tomorrow. But the family move and then my mum decides to move later. And then she has to go through Germany, but she couldn't speak English. So as she was going through Germany, they didn't allow her to get in her transit plane to the UK. Okay. There was a problem with her visa. And then she ended up being stuck in Germany for like 7 months, like on her own. Without like having family and like, and she has a story because back then there was no phones, there was no like, her mom and dad didn't know where she was, and she just kind of got stuck in transit. So she was transiting through Germany and then ended up living there for like 7 months in a hotel. So
did she learn German?
A bit, but said she just spent most of her time in the hotel room crying her eyes out. And she like, just saying, I miss my dad, I miss my mom. She was like, that's the only thing I knew in English. And then she was just lucky that somebody helped her and sorted her visa out for her to go to the UK.
Because she probably didn't even know if she would make it, right?
No, she didn't know if she would make it. No, she didn't know. And then she said that in the hotel she was in, there was a few other people that were like her that she managed to find at the embassy. And they would like help each other with interview questions for the visa and basically like trying to come over to the UK. So my mum has a real story of how she came to the UK. It wasn't common, and when the revolution happened it was really, really hard, especially after the war, because so many people just wanted to get out of the country and they couldn't.
Do you see any values in what your mother went through and what it must have done for her, you know, resilience and ability to, you know, adapt to difficult situations? This is me probably putting some assumptions on what it did for her, but do you see any of that reflected in how you've what influence it's had on you and how you've turned out?
Yeah, for sure, definitely. Like the struggle that even my dad as well, because my dad, even though like he went to like boarding school and he was boarding with other Iranians as well, he wasn't the only Iranian person in his boarding school. As he grew up, it was really difficult for him. Like he didn't want to be dependent on his dad, so he like decided to financially completely stand on his own 2 feet. And my dad has a story of how he really like grafted, like 3 jobs, 4 jobs. And like the struggles that my mum did coming to the UK, and then when she did come to the UK, learning the language, getting a job, becoming a secretary, and then getting a degree, working, like it was growing up very inspirational. And I do think like seeing their values and how they like lived their lives really, really helped, especially with my move to Iran.
And one thing you mentioned, this is actually something that I'd love to know what your thoughts are on, and probably from what you've heard from your mom and your granddad, etc. But one thing I hear about, just like in moments in history, there's kind of always 2 sides to what you hear and what it really stood for and all of that. And you know, the revolution, just like many revolutions, the American, the French, it always starts as peaceful revolution, then there's pushback by the monarchy or the authority, and then it kind of escalates and goes out of control and then ends up standing for more than it probably initially meant to be. And one of the things is, and you touched on it, obviously when the Shah was in power, there was a lot of like economic prosperity that happened, infrastructure was built, you know, it became a very prosperous place to live. But one of the things they were saying of why that kind of revolution started, and Khomeini, if I've pronounced that right, leading that.
Yeah, he did really well, actually.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I would, I think I've listened to a few things. I'm like, yes, I'm not even gonna try and say it again because even when I said it, I'm like, wow, nailed it. Let me just bow out on that high. But one of the things they say is like that American lifestyles had been opposed as an ideal, the ultimate goal, like the Americanism was the model. American pop culture, books, magazines, films had swept over our country like a flood. We found ourselves wondering, is there a way to even maintain the original sort of Iranian or Persian culture?
Yeah.
Is that what you sense from what you've been told, that it was very much this, even though there was this prosperity, any kind of culture was being overtaken by this Americanism, as they describe it?
Yeah. So actually, I read a really, really good book written by Jack Straw, which is the Labour, I think he was Labour foreign minister.
Yeah.
And it's called The English Job. And it's basically the English and Western influence that came upon Iran that led to the revolution. And it goes all the way back from the Persian Empire, and it's the English perspective of somebody who's very, very interested of this complicated country that has so much rich culture and history that is just kind of, it's a mess kind of when you look at it from the West. And it's such a shame because it's such a beautiful country.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so misunderstood. And the book is amazing. And it's difficult to just kind of summarize it all in like a podcast. But there was a lot of things that led to the revolution. And it was, I guess, the influence. I mean, before the revolution, to send a letter from one city to another city in Iran, we had the queen's stamp. So we had the queen's head in Iranian, in the country of Iran. That just goes to show how powerful it wasn't just like they had an influence, like they had a presence.
It was very ingrained. The whole
tobacco industry got taken over. All of the Iranian farmers lost their jobs because the Brits took over their farms, and it was at the time the tobacco was good for you.
Yeah.
And then they took over all the post, and they took away Iranians from their jobs, and they implemented the Indians. So we have a lot of Indians that still are currently in Iran, and that was from the time that the British, most of them are from the time that the British brought them over here to work. And a few other things like the oil, like British Petroleum was founded in Iran and was taken. Yeah. And then what happened is Mossadegh, which was the prime minister at the time, nationalized the oil. And then that's when the coup d'etat happened. And it's like history that the coup d'etat happened and they overthrew Mossadegh because he nationalized the oil, and it was funded by America and the UK. So it is complicated. Like, we have a quote that the Iranians use, which is like, it's an English job, which means something that's like dodgy. We say the English did it because of the influence that the English politics had in the country. And it was really interesting for me to read because I had no idea. I always just thought that this was like an evil regime that just like a small sector of the country wanted this regime. Like, that's the idea that I thought Iran was. And then when I moved here and then I kind of educated myself, I realized, oh my god, like when the revolution happened, 96% of the country voted for this current regime.
Yeah, I didn't know it was that high, but yeah, I heard that there was the majority.
Yeah. And then there was a second vote, so they voted once to say, okay, so you voted for this regime. Now these are the laws. We're going to have hijab. We're going to have, like, these are going to be the rights of women. These are going to be, like, the Islamic laws. And then again, I think it was, like, 76%, like, almost 80% of the country again voted.
And that's when the Islamic Republic really came into effect,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the country voted for it. It's like, the Americans voted for Trump, the Iranians voted for this regime. Like, they did vote for this. It was part of democracy as such. So
that's so interesting, actually. One popular view of the Trump era was how clever he was at, you could say manipulating, but using social media and using that Make America Great Again stance to really win over the American vote. And I think, you know, this was similar, right? Because it was the idea of using that Iran is no longer the Iran or, you know, Persia that we knew. It's being, even though there's so much prosperity and, you know, GDP went up, and I think the oil industry went from a few hundred million to like 20 billion or something. That became the dominant push that, you know, the locals were like, this is what we want. But they, I guess they didn't realize the oppression side of it. That's why I love this conversation and the fact that it's about the Iranian history, because it is so underspoken about and underappreciated for its like complexity and being misunderstood going back centuries. I find it so fascinating, like, you know, back to ancient Persia and Zoroastrianism, which I've brought up before in a previous podcast with another Iranian guy. But, you know, from back then when they were talking about good conquering over evil and women having more equal rights and very much against slavery, there were these really, what would you say, forward-thinking things that they were trying to preach. And but then sometimes all you hear is they're like brutal barbarianism, and you forget there was this whole other bit of their forward-thinking way. But then, you know, the Greeks came and they won and slavery took hold. But It's so fascinating. I think it really should be spoken about more in schools.
No, I do. I mean, when I went to see the Persian ruins in Shiraz, there was I remember there's a wall of all the nations that used to come to see, like, Cyrus the Great, and they used to come with a gift. And you can actually tell by looking at the wall all the different countries and all the different nationalities. And the part that really moved me is that the end of the wall, there's a black person, and you can tell because he's got an afro, and he doesn't have a gift. Everybody has a gift, like one country has like gold and one country has like sheep and one country has like spices. And it was like, and this wall was a representation of Cyrus the Great, which is that it was, I mean, the cylinder, and you probably know, is like one of the first like declarations of human rights. Of, I think actually now it's at the V&A, you can actually go and see the cylinder, but it's like the first official like document, but it's like a cylinder that says how you should rule people of different nationalities and different faith. And it was amazing, like, he saw even like people of different color as people, still as people, and they're on the wall. And I was like, oh my god, like we've still got the black movement going on, yet thousands of years ago this guy was saying, look, hold on a second, no, we're all the same, we might look different, we might be different, but we're all human, we're all united. And it was on that wall, and I was like, oh my god, this is so moving.
I didn't even think about that, because obviously he was quite power hungry, right? He called himself like the ruler of the four corners of the earth, right? That was what he went by as. So you're pretty confident in your abilities there. And he wanted to dominate as much of the planet. And I think at one point it worked out that that regime owned 40% of the world population. But his regime, what would you call it?
Empire.
His empire was very multicultural. It wasn't just like we are all under this one thing. It was very much the more cultures and different sects that you have under your control, the better it is for you, really, rather than trying to convert everyone to this one way of thinking.
Yeah. And it's amazing because I think he's quoted in the Quran, he's quoted in the Torah, he let the Jews free. He openly allowed the Jews to make synagogues. I think there's loads of like biblical, like historical things about Cyrus. He was really great. Like what he did was amazing. And it's a thing that Iranians are so proud of. Like we're part of that. It kind of is a shame of what happened to Iran. Especially like being brought up in the UK, like I was brought up I mean, you know, right? Like, it's a country that doesn't really have that much resources.
Yeah.
Yet
yeah.
The people have everything. If you lose your job, you've got benefits. If you can't pay your mortgage, maybe, like, the government will help you. We have the NHS. Healthcare is free. Oh, my God. And then move to a country that has everything. Oil rich. Like, so much resources. Yet the people, like, don't have, like, a very, very small yeah. percentage of people have a lot. And the rest are, like, suffering. It's really sad. And I guess going into charity work for me was a responsibility, like a humanitarian responsibility. Mm. It wasn't a choice. It was a, like, I came here and I was like, whoa, like a social class difference. I've never seen it like this before. And then I just like fell into charity work. So
that's incredible.
It's a kind of a sad story.
But do you think part of that like you say, I really like how you said it, that you saw it as your responsibility. Do you think part of that came from you being able to relate from the own struggles that you went through growing up? That, you know, I can really relate to how they're feeling. I don't want this to be how it is.
I guess more so the privileges I had growing up.
Okay.
Like, more so than the struggles, as rubbish as sometimes the NHS is, like, wow, like the fact that we even have it, like healthcare is free, is like such a privilege. Like the fact that life is up and down and then the government are there to give you that health, to give you that support if ever you need it, benefits, like, wow. Like, these were privileges that I was like, I didn't even think were, I mean, I always knew, like, okay, it's nice to have this, but I didn't really appreciate it until I came here. But fell into it. Now when I go back to the UK, I'm like, oh my God, it's like, this country's amazing.
Yeah, you can appreciate it more.
Yeah, you appreciate it so much more.
That's awesome. That's a really good way of thinking. I like that you've said that, because that's another benefit of these conversations. It really gets me to think and appreciate that, what can I relate to from what the guest is saying, right? From what you're saying.
Yeah.
And it is great to have those benefits, which I've probably taken for granted. So going through your, say, early years of teenage, when it came to those privileges, but then finding yourself and integrating with finding your friend circle and the social circle and how it was in school versus at home, how do you recall that? Do you recall that being, you know, were things easy? Was it difficult?
My mum was quite smart that she made a lot of extracurricular activities for me.
Yeah.
So my dad had a hard time in boarding school. He was against me going to private school.
Okay.
And wanted me to go to a public school. So, like, I get to see all different kinds of people from different kinds of backgrounds. So I didn't fit in. I don't think, like I said, any of my cousins fit in.
Right.
My mum put me into, like, dancing, singing, acting, music.
The whole shebang.
The whole shebang. Like, I hardly had time to, like, socialize. I was always, like, doing something outside of school, and then weekends were, like, competitions. And then as I was doing my A-levels, I was at Performing Arts College at the same time. So I literally went from performing arts to, like, financial maths.
Why did that happen? Was that because it's more of a stable, secure, sort of, you can map out your future a bit better than something like performance arts where you don't know what's around the corner?
Actually, it was funny because most Iranian parents, they want their children to either be like doctors or lawyers or like engineers. My parents, especially my dad, was like the opposite. My dad was like, you should follow your dream.
Wow.
And when I told my dad I actually want to do financial maths, he almost cried. I still remember it. He was like, it's not my influence. Please don't let it be my influence. I just want you to follow your dream. If you want to be an actress or like, if you want to like, or I think actor now for everyone. If you want to be whatever you want to be, I'm going to support you. Like, I don't want you to pick financial mass because of me. I hope I'm not influencing you in any way. And I was like, definitely not. But what happened is we went on a cruise, and then my mom asked me on the cruise, where would you rather be? Would you rather be there performing or sitting here watching it? And that really had a moment for me. And I was like, actually, I kind of prefer sitting here watching it rather than being the person entertaining. And that kind of just, and my maths was always good. But I didn't want to do like straight math. And then I just chose it myself. Like nobody helped me. Nobody pushed me. I was just like, I'm just going to just go for it. I'm going to try it. And it literally was like so different, like from performing arts college and A-level to like maths.
Amazing. Yeah, I never knew that. But what I do know is that you, was it in second year, you won or you came in second place or you won some kind of prize for a maths competition and you got funding for something? Is that right?
Yeah. Oh my God, how do you remember that? It was actually a business competition. It was City Spark, so it was the thing that Cass put.
Yeah.
And that was really, really random. So there was like a competition. I think it was for like open to everybody. So people that were doing their degrees, master's students. And I just went for it. I was like, this is, and I went for it because they were teaching you how to do a business plan. And my dad was an entrepreneur, and I was like, this is quite interesting. I'm going to like keep that option open if ever I want. I think it's something that will help me like for life. And then I just went for it, and then I got through to the first round, second round, third round. I was like, oh my God, I came second. How did that happen?
That's awesome.
Yeah. So yeah, it was like flat shoes, but like customized for like weddings and clubs and bars. So at the end of the night, if your feet hurt, you'd like get into like flat shoes, and the flat shoes would have like the name of the bride and groom or the name of like...
Oh,
the,
cool.
That was the idea.
It's so funny that you had that, because I think it must have been primary school, maybe secondary school, where, you know, when you have these like kind of Dragon's Den style group workshops.
Yeah.
We had that. And I remember coming up with an idea for retractable or detachable heels, so that instead of girls having to carry both heels and these flats, you were just like detached. And I'm like, this is brilliant. And then obviously having no perspective of what, you know, from the girl's point of view of like how important heels are and what they represent, and just the idea of like, it seems maybe not tacky, but like, nah, you know, detachable or retractable heels will take away the whole value of what heels are. And I'm like, well, I gave it a go, but yeah, I like your version. Your version's good, yeah.
Yeah, it was so random, actually, but I got so many job offers after winning that competition.
Awesome.
And then I was like, I don't know, maybe I'm like, I'll go into consulting or I'll do something like this. And then my dad needed help with his company.
Which is around the financial crisis, right? Or around that time?
It was because of the financial crisis, but a few years after, it affected my dad's industry.
Okay.
And that was because so many of his customers couldn't pay.
Mm.
So literally, as I went in, it was like a letter a day of companies going into administration. And it was like, oh my God, and looking at all the finances, like hundreds and thousands of pounds, we couldn't collect. And then, so I ended up helping my dad for a few years. So I turned down all of them, job offers. And then I ended up going into environmental consultancy. So that's what my dad does.
Okay.
So I was in that for a few years. And then I decided to get married and move to Iraq. So that's basically what happened to me.
So that wraps up part one, and if you have any similar experiences that you can relate to, then find me on Instagram and send me a message. As Saba described it so well, the silent struggle means that sometimes we don't even know that there's so many others out there just like you. And even if it's not something that you need to hear, what you share may be exactly what someone else does. so you never know what impact your message could make. Links to get in touch are in the description as always. Look out for part 2, where we see the next huge chapter that unfolded in Seba's life so far. Until then, as always, make this week even better than your last one.